Temple Place's total death due to coronavirus as of this week as 995,000, while WorldMeters.com says 1.2 million people in the U.S. have died so far from the virus. Experts warn that these are conservative estimates and that the true death toll is probably much higher. Indeed, other figures have been revised this week, including the WHO's estimate of global death due to COVID-19, which is now believed to be around 15 million, a tripling of the organization's previous figure. NBC News figures indicate that the daily rate at which Americans are dying from the virus has slowed compared to what it's been in recent weeks, but it still remains in the hundreds. As of right now, around 360 Americans die daily due to COVID-19 pandemic. The United States is also ahead of every other country in the world in terms of the raw number of deaths it has seen since the pandemic began. Brazil, the country with second highest number of COVID-related deaths, has seen just over 660,000 deaths recorded, NBC News reported. Study after study has concluded that many of the coronavirus deaths in the U.S. could have been avoided through public health measures. The virus itself was politicized in many ways by far-right figures and former President Donald Trump, who continuously downplayed the significance of the virus as his administration disseminated conflicting accounts over the pandemic. Trump, who sought re-election in 2020, saw the practice of mask-wearing to limit the spread of the virus as an affront to his presidency and peddled fraudulent COVID-19 treatments that many of his supporters continue to promote. Trump's actions bred public distrust over the efficacy of vaccines. According to recent Economist YouGov poll, the total number of Americans receiving at least three shots of a vaccine so far, indicating they've received a booster shot since completing their original vaccine series, is 55%. Among self-identified liberals in a poll, that number is much higher, at 68%. Among conservatives, however, it's lower at 50%. But skepticism among conservatives isn't the only reason why the coronavirus pandemic has been especially bad in the U.S. compared to other countries. The for-profit healthcare system in the U.S., too, has been credited with being largely responsible for many avoidable deaths in the U.S. as a more equitable system of healthcare, such as a single-payer model, could have helped more people survive the pandemic. According to a report from The Lancet last year, nearly 40% of COVID-19 deaths in the U.S. could have been avoided had a better healthcare system been in place before the pandemic started, and this information about the virus from the former president and others been limited.
Whenever people talk about the war in Ukraine, they tend to focus on what's happening inside Ukraine. You know, the battles taking place in Mariupol, the Donbass, or the outskirts of Kiev. But that's just half the story. The war in Ukraine is really a catalyst. It's pushing the world towards a multipolar order. Now, right this moment, we are seeing a global realignment. And I don't just mean the shifting of alliances. We're talking about the future of energy sales, global supply chains, the redistribution of power from the concentrated hands of a few in the West towards Asia. This is a seismic shift, both in size and nature, that could very well determine the future of international politics for the next decade. Now, if I told you 2 months ago that EU member states would be paying for their gas in rubles, you would never have believed me. And yet here we are, where the dominance of the US dollar, of the euro, are being challenged. And while the Western press want you to believe that the whole world is united and has the exact same position on Russia, it couldn't be further from the truth. So maybe it really is time to take a hard look at what the so-called international community really means and where it's headed. I'm Richard Medhurst, and this is The Communique. The United States of America has been the global superpower during the 21st century up until this point, and for the better part of the last century. And one of the things that the U.S. derives much of its power from is its currency, the U.S. dollar. So toward the end of World War II in 1944, you had the Bretton Woods system that was put in place, pegging the U.S. dollar to the gold standard. And as a result, the U.S. dollar de facto became the global reserve currency. And that lasted for a few decades, right? And then from 1968 to 1973, that system fell apart. And what emerged soon thereafter in its place was the petrodollar. The United States, in secret, made an agreement with Saudi Arabia, right? They told the Saudis, we'll give you weapons, we'll give you security. And in exchange, the Saudis would conduct all oil sales in U.S. dollars and buy up U.S. bonds. 80% of all oil transactions are conducted in U.S. dollars. Around 55% of global reserves are in U.S. dollars. But now, because of the war in Ukraine, that could very well change. We've had several shocking developments in the last week that you would have never imagined before, right? So because of the war in Ukraine, the U.S., the EU, they have slapped Russia with sanctions to the point that Russia is now the most sanctioned country on earth, with well over 5,530 sanctions. The EU sanctioned everything except Russian energy imports, because the EU relies on Russia, right? About 40% of their gas comes from Russia. However, the UK, the US, they went ahead and straight up banned Russian energy imports. And even though the US isn't a major importer of Russian oil, that announcement of, oh, we're thinking about banning Russian oil, and then actually banning Russian oil, this caused gas prices and oil prices to skyrocket. Oil went up to around $135 a barrel. That's the highest we've seen since July 2008. Gas prices also went up dramatically, Dutch and British. And now all of a sudden, the U.S. is panicking because the U.S. is a net importer of oil. So their oil bill is going way up. And so in order to drive the price back down, the Americans are trying several things, right? First of all, they called up the Saudis and the Emiratis and asked them, please produce more oil. We need to calm global prices. But turns out, Mohammed bin Salman, the Saudi crown prince, he won't even take Joe Biden's phone call. You know, apparently they're unhappy because the United States isn't giving them enough support to kill more Yemenis. Then the United States sent a delegation to Venezuela. Remember, Venezuela sits on the world's largest reserves of oil. And the U.S. used to be one of their top customers, you know, until Bush, Obama, Trump sanctioned them into oblivion. And what's funny here is that for years we've been hearing from the U.S. and their allies that Nicolas Maduro is not the president of Venezuela. Apparently, the president is some guy that no one's ever heard of in Venezuela called Juan Guaido. But now, all of a sudden, when the Americans need oil, oh, now they recognize who's the real president, and they're sending a delegation to beg for oil. And again, who are they talking to? Who's the decision maker? Well, I can tell you it's not Juan Guaido, because they went to speak to none other than Maduro. Now, if the Americans are begging Venezuela for oil and begging Maduro for oil, you know the situation is dire. And on top of that, the Americans have tried other ways to bring down oil prices, right? So all of a sudden, after dragging their feet for, for well over a year, all of a sudden the U.S. wants to rejoin the Iran nuclear deal. Wow. So remember, the idea is that they lift sanctions on Iran, Iran can put its oil back on the global market, and then oil prices go down because the supply is increased. Well, that didn't happen because of multiple reasons. Russia demanded a written guarantee that Iran won't be hit with fresh sanctions for maintaining ties with Russia. However, it's also been reported there are additional details that had to be ironed out, the terrorism designations and so on. The point is, this sudden enthusiasm and this rush from the Americans to finish up the deal, it really shows their desperation. And the United States have basically sanctioned so many people, they've sanctioned everyone, that they've backed themselves into a corner. And who has the upper hand now? Russia, Iran, Venezuela. Let me tell you, that is quite the twist, right? You're really seeing the tables turn right before you. And to make matters worse for Washington, Saudi Arabia not only refused to take their calls, but was even contemplating selling oil to China, not in US dollars, but in yuan, in China's currency, the renminbi. So basically saying, bye-bye, petrodollar. Remember, the entire premise behind the greenback's value is that major oil sales, energy sales, are denominated in US dollars. Now, China imported roughly 17% of its oil from Saudi Arabia in 2021, so this is no joke. At the same time, instead of sanctioning Russia like everybody else, New Delhi struck a deal with Moscow for 3 million barrels of crude. Now, the amount is irrelevant because India consumes more than that in a single day. But the fact that India traded with Russia, continued to maintain ties with Russia, bought this oil at a discount and in rupees, rubles, so dealing another blow to the US dollar. So China refuses to sanction Russia. India and Pakistan refuse to sanction Russia. They're continuing to buy gas and oil like normal, right? Despite the threats to India that it will also face sanctions. That doesn't sound very isolating, right? That's roughly 40% of the world's population there, refusing to toe the Western narrative, refusing to toe the Western line, I should say. And never mind all the other countries that have also refused to condemn Russia. Just look at this map of who has sanctioned Russia. It's basically EU member states, North America, and Japan, and Australia. So in other words, it's the global north, right? This is where all the world's wealth is hoarded. And, you know, all the countries that have not sanctioned Russia are mostly countries you would consider the global south, right? So there's an interesting pattern right there. Western governments and media, they keep saying the international community is united against Russia. I'm sorry, that's not what it looks like. The West is not the international community. It's the West, or the global north, if you want to use the new terms, right? So as a matter of fact, it goes further than that. Let's look at these two UN votes. On March 2nd, the UN General Assembly adopted a resolution condemning Russia. The overwhelming majority of countries did vote to condemn Russia. That's undeniable. But if you look at who abstained, we have Iran, Iraq, China, India, Pakistan, South Africa. Again, that is enormous. That's well over a third of the world's population, you know, above 40%. We're nearing half the world's population. And so later on March 24th, another General Assembly resolution, and pretty much the same result. And 2 days before that, on March 22nd, you had a meeting in Moscow between the Russian foreign minister and who? The ambassadors of all the emerging economic powers, the BRICS, right? So you've got the ambassadors of Brazil, India, China, South Africa, meeting in Moscow with Sergei Lavrov, the Russian foreign minister. Again, that doesn't really look very isolating to me, does it? So you've got the two most populous countries on Earth, two nuclear powers, meeting in Russia's capital with Lavrov. I bet you didn't hear about that on the BBC. Now, Lavrov actually made his first visit to China since the war began, just a week later on March 30th. Right? Soon thereafter, Lavrov actually visited India on April 1st. And now, India has received many visits, many official visits in the past week. You've had officials from the UK, from Greece, Austria, Mexico, they've all come to India. But the only one that India's Prime Minister Modi met with was Lavrov. And again, that pretty much tells you everything you need to know. But this war in Ukraine hasn't been without its setbacks, right? When we talk about a global realignment, that goes both ways. And so we've seen the European Union openly arming Ukraine. That's unprecedented. Germany, the same thing, right? Germany is broken with its past with its stated stance of neutrality. And Germany's going even further. It's rearming. And I think this is something that not a lot of people really grasp. They don't understand how serious this is, that Germany is rearming. That never ends up well. The last time Germany rearmed, we had a Second World War, we had the Holocaust, we had 30 million dead in Europe alone. And now Germany is basically doing what Donald Trump wanted it to do, what NATO wanted it to do, which is increase their defense spending from 1.5 to 2% of their GDP. So Germany's announced 100 billion euros for its military. That's more than Russia. This is incredible, and it could have very, very severe repercussions down the road. Now, as soon as the war started, Pakistan's Prime Minister Imran Khan went to Moscow. He not only met with Putin, he also bought 2 million tons of gas and wheat. He refused to condemn Russia at the UN. He refused to sanction Putin. And the Americans took offense to that, right? Because they want countries they can control. And so soon thereafter, Imran Khan unveiled a plot by the United States to oust him, to unseat him from power. Lo and behold, here we are. And Imran Khan has just been ousted via a vote of no confidence. And like all Pakistani prime ministers before him, he didn't get to complete his five-year term. The Americans are like the mafia. They don't forget, and they punished Imran Khan for daring to conduct an independent foreign policy. And that's the grim reality, right? That shifting towards a multipolar world doesn't come without a price, and the American empire will kick and scream and take down as many with it as it can. To punish Russia, we've seen many corporations pulling out, from McDonald's to Instagram, you name it. And among those are credit card giants Visa and MasterCard, which is actually not that smart when you think about it, because what they've basically done is they handed their market share in Russia to China, right? Because as soon as they left, China's UnionPay came into Russia and linked up with Russia's payment system, Mir, M-I-R. And to make things even more interesting, while all this was happening, Iran and Venezuela started talks to link their payment systems to Russia's Mir. So, you know, further enlarging the cooperation, the international cooperation between these countries, further enhancing the economic ties between the axis of resistance, between the global south. So the West attempts to crush Russia's financial system, you know, by freezing roughly half of the Russian central bank's foreign assets. They haven't entirely succeeded, because as a matter of fact, if you look right now at the value of the Russian ruble, it's regained a lot of its value. It's almost back to pre-war levels at 80 rubles to the dollar. And of course, there are people who say, well, this is just artificial, it's just temporary. Yeah, but it's still astounding. You know, Russian President Vladimir Putin told the Russian Central Bank, and he told Gazprom, the state-owned gas company, to come up with a plan by March 31st to make sure that all gas payments from unfriendly countries be conducted in rubles, not euros or dollars. And again, this is a monumental shift, because as we were saying, most oil and energy transactions are denominated in US dollars. Actually, most of Russia's gas sales to Europe are in euros. And so when Putin says unfriendly countries, he's talking mostly about the EU, the US, Japan, Norway, the countries that sanctioned Russia. And that alone helped shore up the value of the ruble, as European countries, which again, collectively, they get 40% of their gas from Russia. So, you know, they have no choice. They have to go now to Gazprom Bank and open an account in rubles, where their euros will be taken, they'll be sold for rubles in their name at the Moscow Stock Exchange, and then pay for the gas, then also used to pay for the gas in their name. So not only does that drive up the demand for rubles, but it's also smart because it means European buyers are now opening accounts at a Russian bank and not the other way around. So this further insulates both the money itself by keeping it in Russia and Gazprom Bank from potential sanctions in the future. And Joe Biden, the US president, he made clear that there will be food shortages as a result of the conflict. Benchmark gas prices have gone through the roof. People in the US are paying $4 a gallon now. And yes, there was already an energy and fuel crisis before the war. But the Americans and the Europeans have essentially taken a bad situation and made it three times worse. Don't go anywhere. We'll continue breaking down the shift to a multipolar world right after this short break.
Communique is a program in which Richard Medhurst, the independent journalist and political commentator, gives his views of controversial issues of our time and interviews famous politicians and personalities. This program is broadcast every Sunday by IRIB English Radio.
So as we were looking at the other week in Yemen, when the price of fuel goes up, everything goes up. Because fuel is one of the most important commodities and affects everything from healthcare to public transport to groceries. Now earlier I spoke to Scott Ritter about his take on things. Scott is a former intelligence officer in the US Marine Corps. He also served as a United Nations weapons inspector and offers formidable insight, not just in combat-related matters, but international affairs and what it means exactly, you know, transitioning to a multipolar world.
The war in Ukraine is a cleansing moment, and that I don't mean that in a good way. You know, it's like let's say you have a forest that's full of trees that are infected with fungus and insects and all that, and then you have a forest fire come through and burn it all down. That's not necessarily a good thing, except that what emerges in the aftermath of that fire is a viable forest with healthy trees that'll grow better and produce and have a better impact on the environment. What existed prior was just a festering cesspool of infection. The world today is a festering cesspool of infection because of the United States, because of our efforts to impose unilateral hegemony over the world. Ukraine, you can't make the transition from that to what Russia and China are seeking to do without a forest fire. And Ukraine is that forest fire. And it's sad for the Ukrainian people. It's sad for the world. But I think that, for instance, Russia's economic addiction to the West is being broken because of this. The impetus necessary to get Russia to make the strategic pivot away from the West to China and Eurasia is only happening because of this. The liberation of the Russian government from the economic infection of Western influence and the role played by the oligarchs. This is a cleansing moment. There is going to be a radical realignment of centers of gravity in the world. The singular polarity that exists is being broken apart, and it's going to be spread out. And BRICS is probably the initial model of where these centers of gravity are going to, the new centers of gravity are going to emerge.
So, you know, the Russians have demanded that quote-unquote unfriendly countries start paying for gas in rubles, right? So Hungary, they've just announced that they will follow, they will comply. And they're effectively breaking ranks with the EU in saying that. Do you think there's going to be a domino effect? Do you think that other countries will follow suit?
Absolutely. They have no choice. Austria. How does Austria think it's going to get its gas? Austria is going to be paying in rubles. The Vatican is going to be paying in rubles. Slovakia is going to be paying in rubles. And Germany is going to be paying rubles. They claim they're not going to be, but when the economic reality of what's about to happen to Germany hits home, and I would be willing to put money on the fact that Scholz won't survive the year.
Well, how long do you think that people in the West will tolerate these conditions? You know, higher gas prices, higher food prices. Just for the sake of what's being sold in the media as, oh, we're projecting European values and Western values. I mean, how long do you think this is going to go on for? Do you think there will come a breaking point, or do you think the media are so good at propagandizing people that everyone's just going to tolerate it?
You know, the media works when people come home and they have heat, they have food, and they have comfort. The media doesn't work when you come home and you're cold and you're hungry and you're uncomfortable. There's no amount of propaganda that can change those realities. How long is this going to last until the next election? It's over. There's not a single democracy that will have its current government survive the next election if this policy stays in place and their and the economies of that country tank. No government will survive a tanking economy. None. Now, in the United States, we don't have a parliamentarian system. So it's pretty much accepted right now that the Congress, that we have a midterm election coming up in November, and that the Republicans are going to gain control of Congress because the Democrats can't spin this. No matter how much Americans claim they support the Ukrainians, at the end of the day, high gas prices, high food prices are going to basically dictate that the government in power has failed.
So Russia have pegged the ruble to gold. What do you make of that?
Russia has done something very clever. I mean, how many people before this crisis thought that that Putin would link the ruble to the gold standard? But it happened. And it was a genius move. Because now the ruble, believe it or not, is dictating it, because the price of gold used to be linked to the dollar. I mean, you know, it's all based upon the dollar. But now by saying that I think it's 5,000 rubles are worth a half a gram of gold or something like that, that value doesn't change. At the end of the day, 5,000 rubles are worth this much gold. And so now it's the dollar that is linked to the ruble, and he's flipped the script. And again, this isn't a temporary measure designed to, if there hadn't been the divorce of the economies, then I would say there's a chance that this is just games. But there's been the divorce of the economy. So there's literally no impetus, no reason for Russia to play temporary games, because they're not going back to the dollar. They're not going back to the euro. They're not going back to the way things were. They're starting anew. This is about empowering the ruble to function in a trans-Eurasian market, not in an American market, not in a European market, but in a trans-Eurasian market as part and parcel of a currency flux that includes the yuan, the rupee, and other currencies as co-equal currencies of joint, you know, that can be jointly traded. No, Russia, this is the new reality.
You know, let's be clear. This isn't like sanctioning Syria or Iran or Venezuela. The U.S. and the EU, they're so used to bullying smaller countries with zero consequences. But this time, the sanctions go both ways. You know, these bureaucrats in Brussels, they're ready to hurt their own people just to spite Russia. But of course, it's okay for them because they're not the ones who are going to lose their jobs or feel the bite of higher gas prices and food prices. Russia isn't an economic giant like the United States, but it does play a strategic role, and it supplies a good chunk of Europe's gas. You can't just go, yeah, we're going to punish the Russians and forget about it. The ripple effect is going to be enormous. And the West have really shot themselves in the foot, right? Sure, they think they're punishing Russia in the short term, but in the long term, they've helped to speed up the process of de-dollarization and the emergence of a stronger Asia. You know, the West are basically begging Russia and China to find alternatives to SWIFT, to conduct oil and gas sales in denominations other than the US dollar, so either in rupees, rubles, or renminbi. Just to give you another example, on April 8th, China began buying coal and oil from Russia in renminbi. Again, the West are pushing Russia into China's arms and encouraging the global South to break free of the Western financial and monetary system, and proving just how important China's Belt and Road Initiative and greater Eurasia will be in the future. It's astonishing how the war in Ukraine has led to so many changes on a global scale and sped up the transition to a multipolar world, undermining U.S. hegemony in the process. Now again, no one is saying at the flick of a switch, we're gonna wake up tomorrow and find a multipolar world, but things certainly appear to be shifting in that direction at a faster pace than ever before. Thanks for tuning in. I'm Richard Medhurst, and this is The Communique.
You have just listened to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting.
The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily round the clock for listeners across the globe. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran can be heard via the internet, shortwave, FM, and satellite. Our listeners in the Indian subcontinent can listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave 25 meters, 11,865 kilohertz every day from 1520 to 1620 UTC. Also, our listeners in Europe can tune in to the English service of the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave 31 meters, 9,855 kilohertz, and in Southern Africa via shortwave 31 meters, 9,835 kilohertz every day from 1920 to 2020 UTC. Our listeners in Tehran can also listen to our programs via FM 91.5 megahertz. You can also listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and Iran Sat or Bat 5 and via the internet. Our internet address is parstoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Please send your correspondence to the English program PO Box number 19395-6767, Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran, or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about audio quality and other means. Thank you. In the limelight.
The Massachusetts-based pharmaceutical giant Moderna disclosed in a financial filing that it received another $300 million in U.S. government funding for coronavirus vaccine development in March, even as the company hoarded its technology from the world, an attempt to undermine a critical vaccine project in South Africa. Please stay with us for an article in this regard, written by Jake Johnson, journalist. This article is published under the heading, "While Hoarding Vaccine Recipe, Moderna Got Another $300 Million from U.S. Taxpayers." Here's more. The Massachusetts-based pharmaceutical giant Moderna disclosed in a financial filing recently that it received another $300 million in U.S. government funding for coronavirus vaccine development in March, even as the company hoarded its technology from the world, an attempt to undermine a critical vaccine project in South Africa. In its quarterly report to the U.S. Securities and Exchange Commission, Moderna revealed that in March 2022, we entered into a further amendment to its COVID-19 vaccine contract with the federal government, increasing the amount of potential reimbursements by $308 million in connection with costs associated with the clinical development for the adolescent and pediatric studies and Phase 3 pivotal study. The maximum award from the Biomedical Advanced Research and Development Authority, inclusive of 2020, 2021, and 2022 amendments, was approximately $1.7 billion, the filing reads, adding, "All contract options have been exercised. As of March 31, 2022, the remaining available funding net of revenue earned was $378 million. The Zain Rezvi, a researcher with Public Citizens Access to Medicines program, called the sum of public funding that has flowed to Moderna staggering. Moderna reported recently that it sold $5.9 billion worth of its COVID-19 vaccine in the first quarter of 2022, far surpassing analysts' revenue and profit expectations and briefly sending the company's stock price soaring. The biotechnology corporation has repeatedly come under fire in recent months for selling much of its vaccine supply to rich countries, even as billions of people in poor nations remain without access to shots more than 2 years into the pandemic, which has killed nearly 15 million people worldwide. The company has also faced criticism for massively overcharging for doses. Known as mRNA-1273, the coronavirus vaccine is Moderna's only product on the market, and the company has previously admitted that 100% of the funding for its vaccine development program has come from the United States government. Moderna received $1.7 billion as public investment for R&D, but it still refuses to be accountable to the public. Shelly Gupta, communications advisor at Doctors Without Borders, said recently, adding, "The corporation must give it back by sharing the tech with others and make this vaccine available to everyone and everywhere." David Mitchell, the founder of Patients for Affordable Drugs, summarized the arrangements between Moderna and the U.S. government as, "We take on the risk. They take away the profit." Last week, Moderna shareholders voted down resolutions urging the company led by billionaire CEO Stephen Bancel to take part in technology transfer efforts such as the World Health Organization's South Africa Hub, which has thus far succeeded in creating a close replica of Moderna's mRNA-based coronavirus shot without the corporation's help. Far from supporting the WHO's groundbreaking work, Moderna has been accused of trying to derail it by shielding its vaccine technology with sweeping and long-term patents. Moderna has even fought with the U.S. government over ownership of key vaccine technology that National Institutes of Health scientists helped develop. Spike protein technology developed by NIH researchers has been used in at least five coronavirus vaccines, including Moderna's shot. Moderna is currently seeking emergency use authorization for its coronavirus vaccine for children between the ages of 6 months and 6 years. In a joint statement recently, four House Democrats lamented that Big Pharma continues to shamelessly protect its monopoly pricing scheme despite receiving tens of billions of public dollars to develop COVID-19 vaccines. "As such, the progress of global vaccination has been slower than we had hoped," said Representatives Jan Schakowsky, Rosa DeLauro, Lloyd Doggett, and Earl Blumener. The statement was issued on 1 year anniversary of Biden administration's endorsement of efforts to temporarily waive vaccine-related patents at the World Trade Organization, WTO. Since the administration's announcement last May, however, little discernible progress has been made toward a final waiver agreement as the U.S. has dragged its feet and leading European nations have obstructed the progress at every turn. Earlier this week, the WTO unveiled a purported compromise plan that vaccine equity campaigners slammed as complete garbage. The four House Democrats noted recently now second-generation vaccines are being developed to protect people from being infected by recent variants. If the world repeats the grotesque inequity of access to new vaccines and the most effective treatments, we know that will happen because we just lived through it. Millions of people will suffer in raging outbreaks, which will also foster the development of new variants that can evade the new generation of vaccines, they added. The only way to end the pandemic is to expand the production of vaccines and treatments. We cannot wait, they added.
Aperture. Welcome back to Aperture, everyone. First part of the documentary witnessed the rise and fall of gold used as currency throughout human civilization, from first gold coins in Lydia to their dominance of over 1,000 years in the Byzantine Empire. But what role does gold play in the modern international economic arena, and how has it made a comeback after the dollar took over for about half a century?
Under the gold standard, in which money is issued based on the reserved gold, the prices of commodities are more stable because the government cannot simply issue more money. Also, trade deficits remain under control. Trade deficits under the gold standard refer to the effect of domestic gold transferring over to other countries due to an increase in revenue. If there is less gold, less money is issued. With less money, consumption and income automatically decrease. Export relatively increases, and the country sees a surplus in trade. Under the gold standard, the value of money is very stable unless the amount of gold drastically increases. However, because of this, the gold era collapsed. The gold standard, in which issued money is tied to gold. When the economy began to grow rapidly, thanks to the Industrial Revolution, the amount of money needed to grow as well. However, because of the limited amount of gold, sufficient amount of money could not be issued. This problem became more evident during World War I. Countries that participated in the war had to issue large sums of money to fund the war. One by one, they began to discard the gold standard. The gold standard faced another crisis during the Great Depression. As countries began to exchange foreign currency for gold in fear of the never-ending depression, it led to disputes over gold.
As it has endured,
we'll revive and will prosper.
In 1933, President Roosevelt nullified the gold standard, and more countries began to discard it. After World War II, the world's gold gathered in the U.S., and the gold standard was gradually disappearing. In 1944, each country's representative gathered in Bretton Woods, USA. 44 countries participated, but it was actually a battle between England and the US, and in the end, the US won. Since then, the dollar became the key currency of the world. It was a defining moment for the U.S. as it became the empire of finances. However, during the Vietnam War, the dollar faced a crisis. More money was issued to fund the war, which led to increased prices and deficits. When the value of the dollar plunged, each country began to ask for gold conversion. It was the first crisis that the dollar had faced. In 1971, U.S. President Nixon declared the prohibition of gold conversion. He no longer allowed exchanging dollars for gold. Along with the Nixon shock, the era of gold ended and the Bretton Woods Agreement collapsed. The financial system in use today is the result of the Nixon shock. The U.S. is still home to the largest economy, maintains the dollar as the international currency, and other countries put their destinies in the hands of the dollar. The U.S., which had abandoned gold, now had the power to issue as many dollars as they wanted. The Asian financial crisis in 1997 that drove Hong Kong, Taiwan, and Korea to the edge of a cliff was the result of the U.S. recklessly issuing dollars. The reckless printing of the dollar can threaten any given country. This is all possible because of the absence of gold as a standard. The gold and the dollar, which were linked together at one point, now were on diverging paths. The ups and downs of civilizations and currency have a special relationship. If a strong civilization appears, its currency becomes strong as well, and if the currency value falls, the civilization also wanes. Whether they were coins or paper money, overissuance of money always led to the collapse of an empire.
A powerful government means powerful economy. The reason why the government is powerful because the economic system is so strong and the people work hard, make money, pay the tax. So the government can get more and more tax, which has a lot of wealth and a lot of spending power, which keep the government strong, keep the country or empire strong. But why such system can have a stronger economy compared to others? I think money is a big issue. It's a very important.
Ancient Rome is the representative case where the empire's history followed the ups and downs of currency. Once ancient Rome expanded to the Mediterranean Sea, the circulation range of the currency did as well. The expansion of the local currency led to stronger national power through the acquisition of local resources. Periods of stable prices and a booming economy coincide with the peak of the Roman Empire. In 54 AD, the peaceful reign of the Roman Empire ended under Emperor Nero. Nero reduced the amount of gold used in coins and made thinner, smaller ones. His successors also degraded the coins, and the value of money plunged. currency system completely collapsed, and the government had to collect taxes through goods and services instead of money. The strong empire had reverted back to the time of the exchange of goods. In 476 AD, the thousand-year-old civilization of the Roman Empire collapsed. Even after the collapse of the Western Roman Empire, the Byzantine Empire continued to flourish and survived for another 1,000 years. The secret to the survival of the Byzantine Empire, despite frequent battles, was the bezant, the Byzantine coin. However, after the Crusades, even the value of the bezant plunged. In 1453, the Byzantine Empire fell when the last bezant was used up. The Byzantine Empire disappeared along with the bezant, and the Ottoman Turks became the rulers of a new empire. The special relationship between the fall of a currency and an empire can also be seen in China. During the Bukong dynasty, people in Sichuan made coins out of iron. At the time, about 20,000 iron coins were needed to buy a roll of fabric. A carriage was needed just to buy a roll of fabric. So in order to solve this problem, the world's first paper money, gilja, was invented using iron coins as collateral. However, 100 years later, due to the government's over-issuance of money, the world's first paper money disappeared. Once the currency system collapsed, the Song dynasty lost its military and political power and collapsed under the Mongolian invasion. The Yuan dynasty that watched the Song dynasty's fall issued gyocho, based on silver, and created a stable currency system. However, the problem was the endless wars. Every time it faced financial difficulties, the government overissued gyocho, and the currency system collapsed. Once the currency system collapsed, the Yuan dynasty fell like all other empires. The national crisis shook the trust in currency, and the failure of the currency system led to the collapse of an empire. A strong currency and a strong empire were the two pillars that drove history. New York, USA. The Federal Reserve Bank on Wall Street houses the world's largest gold safe. In the 122 gold safes that are located 24 meters underground, is gold that other governments, central banks, and international organizations entrusted. After the gold standard disappeared, gold that lost its place to the dollar disappeared into the dark. Then, what backs the value of currency? It's the world's key currency that is the foundation of international trade and transactions. The source of that power is in national strength. The British pound dominated the world's economy for 100 years, and then the US dollar took over. It was the result of the currency war among nations.
Oftentimes, over time in history, you find that as countries change in their economic power, the UK and then the US, reserve currencies change. But I think we're moving to a world where there's a lot more engines of growth, and it makes sense to have multiple reserve currencies. So this is a function not just of the United States, but really of the changing world economy. But it does mean, though, for the United States, if other currencies are used as reserve holdings, then there will be a relative fall in the demand for the dollar as a foreign exchange reserve holding. And that's worrisome if the U.S. has a lot of debt to sell.
The Byzantine bezant, 700 years. The British pound, 100 years. These are the number of years these key currencies dominated the world. Then how much longer will the dollar rule the world? People's fantasy about the dollar shattered in September 2008. The financial crisis that originated from the US left the world in fear, and people immediately rushed to obtain gold. The moment greed turned to fear, the emperor, sleeping in the dark, awoke from its slumber. After 40 years of sleep, gold has returned. The price of gold rose 22 times in 2010, which is a record within a given year. Now the world is rushing out to buy gold. The central banks of each country bought 216 tons of gold just in the first half of 2011. The price of gold is skyrocketing, and the US and the dollar is plunging endlessly.
Even before the financial crisis, there were trends underway which meant it made it likely that the U.S. would not play as dominant a role in international finance as it has in recent decades. You had the creation of the euro, a currency for a very large economic area, and the euro was beginning to play a larger role. In addition, you've got the emergence of China, already the second largest economy in the world and growing very rapidly, that makes it natural that over time, as Chinese financial markets develop, as they open up their capital markets, that I think we will see the renminbi play a larger role as well.
Just as it defeated England at the Bretton Woods Conference, defeated France via the Nixon shock, put Germany and Japan under control, will the U.S. be able to win the currency war once again?
Well, the United States is now in relative decline to the rest of the world. As you probably know, the 19th century was the century of the U.K. It went into decline during the 20th century, and it's no longer anywhere near the major economy in the world. The 20th century was the century of the U.S. We're now in relative decline, too. The largest creditor nations in the world now are China, Korea, Japan, Hong Kong, Taiwan, Singapore. The assets and the money, the wealth, is in Asia now. The United States is the largest debtor nation, not just the largest debtor nation in the world, we're the largest debtor nation in the history.
Once the U.S., the financial empire built on debt and the power of the dollar, began to shake, the world began to debate about the new key currency. The one that's receiving the most attention is gold.